Tansay, hello and welcome. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Today we continue our conversation with Squamish First Nation's own Kung Jide. Even when I was going through school, my younger life, in textbooks, as you know, when you would open them, it wasn't really mentioned as much. Maybe one, if you were lucky, two pages, if you were really lucky, to see, like, you know, the definition or the description of, you know, indigenous people, especially here in Alberta. And since the 215 discovery, you know, we're starting to see a difference in that. And you had mentioned that, you know, because of your book that you wrote almost in a textbook-like format, as an author and a writer yourself, do you strongly believe that we should see more of that in textbooks where it gives a better definition, if not to rewrite it in a sense for education purposes, as to be seen not only in elementary schools, but middle schools and high schools, as well as post-secondary?
Definitely. I 100% agree. And I do recall, you know, that a textbook company from Toronto contacted me out of the blue by email, and they asked me to review a paragraph that someone on their team had, or on their staff had written about Haida Indigenous people. And I'm like, oh, wait a second. Hold on here. I said, you need to rethink this whole paragraph. And I said, you need to actually get a Haida Indigenous person to write this paragraph for you. I can tell that it was a settler that wrote it. You know, we need to be telling our own stories in our own words. And I gave them a list of people they could contact that I could find for them if they so chose, you know, whether they be a weaver or they be a carver or they be a singer or, you know, a drummer, you know, dancer, any of those things. I let them know, you know, like there was quite an extensive list that they could have chosen someone to do this. But they asked me to do it. And I forgot all about it, you know, like I did it. It took me a while to get it all together and everything like that. And I remember, I don't know how many years later it was, I was performing at a middle school and I telling these stories, and these grade 7, 8 girls came running up to me and they said, you're in our textbook, you know. I'm like, what? No. There's no way. You're confusing me with someone else. And they said, no, we'll show you. And they ran to their locker and they brought this book. And there I was in the middle of their textbook. I'm like, oh, my God. Okay. So I contacted the textbook company and said, hey. And they said, oh, well, we asked you to do this. Remember, you know, like I kind of reprimanded them and said, no, you cannot. We need to write our own stories, just like you were saying. You know, about our textbooks, you know, and all the information. It has to be information written by Indigenous people right across the country. So regardless of the territory that we're in, so if it's Inuvialuit or Inuit in the north, you know, or if it's the Plains people, if it's Cree, if it's, you know, people from Sutina, you know, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing their names correctly, but, you know, if it's Ojibwe, if it's Anishinaabe, Mohawk, you know, right across the country, you know, really there are enough people who have this knowledge, and all these textbook companies can contact all of them and have them write their own portions about our culture, about our history, about our stories, about our language, you know, about our traditions, our houses, you know, how they used to be, and maybe how our feast houses might be today. You know, they might look exactly the same as the way the ancestors had them in the past. But, you know, I really feel strongly that it's possible. I mean, these textbook companies can no longer say, well, we don't have anybody, we don't know anyone. Well, that's simply not true anymore.
That's true. Yeah. No. And you know, like I said, it's, you know, over the years, like I've been out of school now for several years, almost 10 years now. But back then, I just remember like the only thing that was mentioned was the buffalo jump and nothing else. There was nothing else mentioning of any of the chiefs, the culture, or anything like that. Heck, even when I was in school, I remember at one point we had language class, like they would actually teach Cree. And one day, just without any warning, they just said, we're not teaching Cree anymore. They taught other languages like Spanish, Arabic, and French, but Cree was just removed. And then shortly after, they would replace it with Native Cultural Arts, which would teach you how to bead, which was okay. But what happened to learning Cree? Like, I was enjoying it. I remember we were given an ingredients in Cree of how to make bannock. And my bannock came out like a hockey puck, but I was like, I didn't learn Cree fresh, you know, fresh growing up and everything else. And, you know, and I don't know if it's like this, you know, up in BC, but I know for here in Alberta, when I used to ask my mom, I used to say, Mom, like, I want to learn how to speak Cree. And for years, I didn't even know that I was speaking it, because I wasn't told it was a Cree word. Like my grandma Bella, who I always used to refer as my grandma Bella, or Chapon, which means great grandmother in Cree. I didn't even know that's what it meant. I just used to say, hi, Chapon, and she'd be, hi, little one, and all that stuff, right? But I didn't know that was Cree until when I started working here. I was like, really? Chapon is Cree? So, you know, and so in regards to the language as well, you know, how important is it for those that, you know, may not have grown up surrounded by the language to get involved into learning how to speak the language, especially when it comes to Haida language as well?
I think it's especially important. It's one of the things that I keep hearing over and over again, you know, like, from a lot of Indigenous people, whether they be elders, you know, mainly it's elders, but if we do not have the language, then we do not have the culture. And there is so much in our languages that cannot be translated into English. We just don't have the language for it. And one of the things that I learned early on, once I was learning our language, is how there are these huge portions of our language that can't be translated into English, and it's actually much more descriptive. Our languages are way more beautiful than English ever could be. English, it feels very limiting to me, and all of our Indigenous languages, you know, a lot of it has to do with verbs, so they're action words. Not always, but a big part of it has to do with that, because our language is a living language. And the other part that I noticed about our language is it's really quite humorous. You know, like, Indigenous people are the funniest people on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, you know. Yes. With, you know, and it could be in English or not, but one of the things that I did notice is listening to elders telling stories with each other, most of it is just laughter the whole day. And it made me think, well, I want to learn more of this language so that I can get in on that, because I love laughing. I mean, everybody was laughing, even if they didn't know what they were laughing about. But later on, if you know, like, I remember even hearing from my father, because his father, my paternal Chinny or grandpa, he spoke the old dialect of our language, and it no longer exists, because he was raised by his own grandparents. They were very old people, and they raised him in a very traditional way. And because he went to Kokolita Residential School in Sardis here in BC, close to Chilliwack, here on the Lower Mainland, he didn't teach his language to any of his 10 kids. But and he was the storyteller that I knew about. But my dad said he remembers his dad telling him stories about how, you know, pretty much every evening, everyone would go down onto the beach, because the village is right, you know, all facing the beach. They would light a bonfire and they'd sit around the fire and they would tell stories all night long and just laugh and laugh. The kids would be around and they'd get to hear it. And my dad must have been there at one point, because, you know, he was trying to ask his dad, like, well, what does this mean? And his dad would try and tell him, but he'd say, but, you know, it doesn't sound funny when I translate it into English. It's only funny in our language. You know, it just loses a huge component of, you know, the story is just completely lost once you translate it into English. It's funnier in our language. And that's what I found, too, is, like, You know, whether we're around other Indigenous people or not, we've got a great sense of humor and we laugh about a lot of things, which I totally love because laughter is healing. And I believe tears are healing too. And actually both are good, we're meant to express all of our emotions. But I do speak my language every day and I translate, you know, into English because I'm often surrounded by people who don't understand it. I am mentoring my youngest child in the language for the third year. And after just four sessions, we were speaking fluently with each other. And it made us laugh even harder. We just thought, how could this happen so quickly? It's phenomenal.
Well, and you know, like, I remember growing up too as well, like, I would be little and my mom would be surrounded by her family members who are also that speak Cree. And my mom never spoke it, but she understood it. She would speak little words here and there, you know, saying tapwe or ihe or hi-hi and all that stuff. But I remember, and I asked her, I said, well, what's everyone saying? And she's like, adults are talking. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then as I grew older, they only spoke Cree when the little ones were around so that they didn't know what they were talking about. They would laugh. They would sing in Cree as well. And, you know, my grandma, my Chapa, my grandma Bella, and my grandma Leona especially, they were like the glue of the family. And all elders are glue of the family, especially when it came to humor. And I joked with my Uncle Sam one time because he used to call me Monkey Man. And I said, that's not my elder name, is it? He said, it could be. So I have to ask as well is when your books were released to the public and you saw your books be available for purchase as well as being available in schools and in children's hands, what was your first thought when you saw that?
I was amazed, and I still get amazed because I have friends that, you know, they take pictures of either students, you know, holding my book, or a teacher has my book on their desk, you know, that, you know, they're going to use it, I guess, for a lesson. You know, I remember on Truth and Reconciliation Day, you know, on September 30th, someone sent a picture of my book on a display in a window, you know, along with like a raven sculpture. And Raven is the clan that I belong to. So they had, my book was prominent right in the middle there. I'm like, holy cats, I really am deeply touched by that. I always am. And bowled over by it. And sometimes people don't know when they meet me, you know, they're that I've written a book. They're like, oh, you wrote this book? I'm like, yes, I did. Sometimes people don't believe me at all. And that makes me think eventually I might get brave enough and officially change my English name to my traditional name. But for some reason, my mother does not like me using my traditional name. She only uses my English name. I guess it's just part of what she knows. And so she's the only one, you know, and maybe one cousin, you know, kind of, who still does it, but everybody else calls me Kung Jade because I insist on it. but when I see how, you know, when I hear from parents, you know, about how much, or even directly from students, how much they love my book, it makes me so grateful that, you know, that it's still out there and doing that and enjoying it. I mean, even the local bookstore in my neighborhood, they keep it in stock. They're an Indigenous-owned and operated bookstore here, and they are so awesome. So I love to go in and support them. And I mean, I know I don't need any more books, but I keep going in there anyways because I can't resist. I'm like, you know, my partner's like, well, let's go to the library instead. And I'm like, no, I need this book. It wants to go home with me. Yeah, what can I say? I love giving it as a gift. If there's like a new baby in the family or a friend, or sometimes there's a fundraiser Like there was a fundraiser I supported this young Indigenous mom whose baby ended up getting cancer, sadly. I think she's winning that battle, but I sent copies of my books, you know, to help with raffles and stuff like that, because it's really, really difficult. We all live in small communities, and when we live in a small community, it means we have to go to a bigger city to actually get all the treatment that we need. And, well, you know, I'm going on 26-year cancer survivor myself, so I understand what it means to be really unwell and to come out of that and to be supported, to be completely loved by people, and people that I didn't even know, you know, kind of thing. So it feels to me like giving back.
That was Kung Jade from Squamish First Nation. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Next, we continue our conversation with Stony Nakota First Nations, Teresa Snow. And of course, Teresa, you know, we're in the month of celebrating National Indigenous Celebrations Month, you know, celebrating National Indigenous Peoples Month and Day, of course, coming up soon. So with that being said, what does that month, the month of June for National Indigenous Peoples Month and Day mean to you?
I think it's a really good time of reflection, of celebration and honoring and coming together and self-care. Because if we look at how National Aboriginal Day came about, it's one of the things of it is coming from the Ecumenical Conference out at Morley, which started in the 70s, which originally started at Crow Agency in the 70s, and then they needed an event to do it, and it was either Morley or Standing Rock was going to do it. And I think that's always interesting, because you look at Standing Rock just a couple of years ago, they did that protest about the water. And so even today, years later, those two areas, Standing Rock is still significant in keeping to the traditions and the wellness of the people. And we took it on at Stony Nakota to do that ecumenical conference. And from that was the committee, and they put in a letter to the United Church of Canada that was supplemented or supported. And they met with, back then, AFN was National Indian Brotherhood. And so there were key players in that who helped to formulate what today is National Aboriginal Day. And it's really cool to understand that some of it comes from Morley. You can read about it in my late dad's book, These Mountains Are Sacred Places. James Treat talks about it in Around the Circle, the Sacred Fire. And we're the only group, I think, or area, the event, the ecumenical conference that had Man Alive come out, film, the Smithsonian come out and film, and National Geographic come out and film at these times when it was a way of Indigenous groups getting their ability to practice their traditions. And so everybody came from all over. I remember that sitting there and the late Ernest Situsis talking, and we'd be under a willow arbor and hearing them talk and the stories and the teachings that they gave. And when I think about the month of June, I think about that when all our people came together and everybody helped out with camping and cooking. And it was a way for them to celebrate who they were. They had powwows there, they had dances at night, singing, they had storytelling. Everybody was doing something without getting paid or without a want for it. They just did it because they wanted to. And so when I think about National Aboriginal Day in June, it's about ceremony, because we have Sundance. We have other ceremonies that go on as well too. And so powwows are starting up. Graduations. It's a lot of time of celebration and honoring Mother Earth as well, too, because we have these ceremonies and a lot of time we're away from the land, and it's Mother Earth rejoicing in that we get to come out. If we're living in the city or we haven't been out to that sacred place, we come back. And it's a revival for her, too, when you look at it. So it's really a holistic paradigm that we live in, and we have to be cognizant of that when we're doing this, when we're going out on the land, offering gifts for protocol for teachings, if we're going to harvest poles or harvest wood or harvest the mints and herbs that are going to be coming up now that we're going to use for ceremony or doctoring or gifting. And so just to be aware of that and mindful of that and leave enough for others. And so for me, it's a celebration of honoring, acknowledging, and remembrance for everybody.
And of course, you know, with after National Peoples, our Indigenous Peoples Day, of course, in regards to that, you know, we're celebrating many Indigenous people that have done so many great things, especially within their communities as well, and to recognize the culture and all that. Of course, with that being said, you know, Teresa, you've done a lot of groundwork to, you know, to help those that now will, you know, carry forward and do more great things in a sense for their communities and for the culture as well. When you see people like, say, Ashley Collingbull or Fawn Wood or somebody that's going out there and doing amazing things to showcase, to showcase the culture, the background and everything, whether that be in movies, music, or even in the world of social media, what does that mean to you to see stuff like that happening now today?
It makes me really happy to see that, because there's been, as much as they're out there doing that, there's been probably so many struggles and challenges that they've had to face and endure to get to where they're at. And it just, it makes me happy because it's a pathway for them, and everybody has a different role and gift. And so to see them up there acting or singing or providing whatever it is, gift that they have, it just shows me that all the work that's been done has led to that pathway opened for them to be able to do that. And then it just, again, shows our youth that there's so many things you can do, so many things that we have that are different, but yet unique, and to never give up hope and to always try. And that was one thing my late dad would say. He'd say, if you see someone doing something, don't think you can't do something as well. And it doesn't have to be the same. It can be different. And don't think that there's ways to stop you. Everybody has a gift and something to offer. And so when I see all our young people, all our other Indigenous actors, performers, artisans doing things, I think that's really good, because we have to think of that abundance for our people and always want the best for each other, because I rather hear good stories about positive things that have happened or achievements or just even being able to get through the day, because there's so much that's gone on with mental health, especially since the pandemic. Just to be able to do that, that's a really good thing, because there's so many things we've battled against, and we have to remember to be gentle with ourselves, because this change and the impacts have only come about in the last couple hundred years. And so it's going to take a while. We're not going to be able to get over everything or fix everything or recover it in the next 5 years. It's going to take a while to do those. And so to always be gentle and compassionate with each other, and always to be kind to each other, because you never know what someone's going through.
And of course, we're going to continue talking about some of the other accolades and stuff that you've accomplished going through the list here, as well as, you know, you were also featured as an artist on Aboriginal People's Television Network show Spirit Creations in 2005. And in 2006 and 2007, you were also invited as a designer to showcase clothing at the annual CANAB Festival in Toronto, Ontario. What was that experience like, going through that to showcase your hard work that was made with your two hands, but also with the knowledge and, of course, to showcase the culture within your work for all eyes to see in Toronto and on television?
It was, again, a really powerful experience, and I didn't even submit my work to be in the application. My best friend had submitted it for me without me knowing. She had pictures of my work and she filled out the application. As at that time, I was transitioning from being in a relationship to becoming a single mother. And me using my gifts of sewing and beading is how I supported my girls at that time. And so for me, it was a real learning experience, because I had to delve into my inner strength and qualities and things I was able to do at that time to support my girls and me. And I didn't think I had it in me to do that. And she had filled out the application and I got accepted and she let me know. And so that was, for me, it was huge because we don't see the impact we have on others or the gifts that we have, and people see us in a different light. And so for me, it was an opportunity to acknowledge the work I did and the sewing I did and the creations I did. And it was like, it was so unexpected. And she told me, and it was like, yeah, I'm just at a loss for words because you don't realize that what people see in you, and you think, oh, I'm doing this or that, and then realize after, oh, okay, well, this is where they think you're at or how they see you. And that's really amazing to see. It's really humbling to see, and going there and seeing all these other designers and performers, and it was during their powwow too. It was a chance for me not to be in the dancer role, but to be creating clothing and art form that expressed who we are as Indigenous people, and that we are talented, we are smart, we think of things in a holistic way and in a paradigm of clothing, that we're clothing our spirit, essentially. And so for me, it was a beautiful opportunity. And then to get to go back the second year again and show as a designer, and then being on APTN on the Spirit Creations again, that was talking about the clothing and the beadwork and why we do it. And it's a connection to who we are as Indigenous people, and it's healing through dance and the stories and designs that come from it. And so that was like, I think back, I knew a little bit then. I've learned a little bit more, but there's still so much more to learn. I know a little of things, and I try to share that with people. So,
and of course, with sharing that, you're also making huge impacts within those that may not know so much about the culture and the diversity, of course, with the language and the teachings that follow with it. Now, of course, what a lot of people may not know, Teresa, is that you were also the head dance judge for other celebrations, including University of Lethbridge Powwow, Alexa Celebration, Calgary Exhibition, and Stampede's 100th celebration and K-Day's celebration in 2017. You also helped as a coordinator for other celebrations and endeavors, also in receiving extra roles in film production. On top of the powwow stuff, you've also been a Canadian judge for the Indian National Finals powwow pageant. When you're a judge for those pageantries and for the dances and stuff like that, when you get the call to do that role, what comes to mind when you get that call? And also, when you're there in person, what's that experience like to look at all the dancers in front of you, to focus on their, are you focusing on their stepping, what they're wearing as their regalia? What are some things that you do in that role particularly?
Yeah, that's a lot. And it comes from, I guess, lived experience or experience being in the powwow circle and going to powwows and being a dancer, being a competitor, but also learning and becoming a parent and having your kids dance and seeing both sides, being a dancer and understanding the roles and responsibilities, but then also becoming a judge and understanding those roles and responsibilities. And so I've had a lot of different experiences in which to base things on. And again, with the intention to look at the teachings of the dance or how the footwork is being done and the song. Is the song appropriate for the dancers? Do we need another song? Or what are the conditions that the dancer is dancing in? Is it a hard cement floor? Is it outside? And then with pageant, what are we judging them on? Is it a traditional teaching? Is there knowledge of their outfit? Is it their education? What are their aspirations? And a lot of different things coming about, but always just happy and blessed to have the opportunity to share knowledge and to learn as well too, because we don't just learn from others that are older from us. We learn from the youth, we learn from the children, we learn from experiences that we have maybe with one person for 5 minutes and them talking and sharing a story with us that will follow us for our lifetime, that will guide us over our lifetime. And so it's always been about I was once told when I was in Shakopee at the we're there traveling, and my mentor, my supervisor at the time, they told me, everyone you meet is a contact, and so always be gracious with them and thankful for them and what they teach you or what they show you whether it be negative or positive, that's always a teaching to keep with you and be mindful, because everyone you meet is a contact. And so everywhere I've gone, when I meet people, whether it's from someone in a high position or someone working as the janitor or whoever, I try to say hello to everybody and be pleasant to them and understand that they're all doing a role that they're gifted with, and have that same approach and to learn from them too. And then in the pageants, judging that, like being asked, my friend kept asking me if I was coming to the pageant or to the PAL, and I was like, no, I don't think so. And then finally she said, I need a Canadian judge. Can you come down? I know you've gone to pageants. You've been in pageants. You've gone to PALs. You know, and I need a Canadian judge, and you would fit this because you've been a princess. You've had that role. You know what it requires. But also, too, you have education about the teaching and the dance and the dresses. And so I'd like you to be the Canadian judge. And so I was like, oh, okay, then sure, I can do that. So then I went down, and I hadn't danced in a long time. I was I stopped dancing in 99 when my son passed. I was at a PAL and he passed away. And then 2007, I was reinitiated into the PAL circle. And I didn't have my outfit. I wore my, one of my mentors, Irene, I wore her outfit, and she danced me back in. And so then after that, I start working on my outfit, getting it together, getting the beads, the plumes, the feathers, everything ready for it. And then the opportunity came up to go to Vegas and go to the PAL. And I thought, this is so cool to have a PAL during INFR and be asked to come down and judge. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go to a PAL down there and it's the first ever, why don't I dance? And so then I worked on my outfit. And my nephew and his wife were really supportive. They've always been supportive of me dancing and the artwork I do with, as well with my family. But they really encouraged me to dance. And so then when I went down to Vegas, I ended up dancing there for the first time in a long time. And for me, that was really, it was really cool because it was taking care of me and my self-care because I hadn't danced for so long. And like I said, growing up, I was always used to going to PALs, and I loved dancing and being a part of that. And so going back into the circle and people seeing me, but being in the circle and hearing the songs and being able to dance, that was really fulfilling to me in that aspect. And so, yeah, I think we all come to healing in different ways in our lives, whether it's through dance, music, artwork, being on the land, creating different things. It's just whatever your passion is and leads you into that role of fulfilling your dream.
That was Stony Dakota's own Teresa Snow on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Kung Janae and Teresa Snow. Tune in next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.